dark, brooding clouds, and in black and white, the Nazi flag bearing the swastika.
In September 1938, British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain travelled to Munich to strike a deal with the leader of Germany, Adolf Hitler. Hitler had already violated the peace treaty signed after the First World War by moving troops into Rhineland and Austria. Now he was threatening to invade Czechoslovakia. Chamberlain was determined to avoid another world war.
German troops march by. Now Neville Chamberlain addresses the public.
Here is the paper which bears his name upon it as well as mine.
He returned to Britain, brandishing the famous scrap of paper which he believed secured peace with Germany. You could almost hear the nation's sigh of relief. But not from this man, Winston Churchill.
A photo of him smiling in a bowler hat.
He knew the true extent of Hitler's ambition. He recognised that the Nazi leadership, with its persecution of Jews and insatiable hunger for conquest, was not a regime you could negotiate with.
The German army parades through busy streets. Now Adolf Hitler.
It was as if Churchill's whole life had been preparing him for this. He always felt it was his destiny to lead the nation to victory. And at the most dangerous moment in our history, his leadership would make him the greatest Briton of all time.
Another photo of Churchill blurs out of focus. A butterfly flutters over a cheering crowd of people holding up banners. Some show the face of Winston Churchill, others John Lennon. Now Darwin. Elizabeth I, Brunel, and Shakespeare. Newton, Cromwell, Nelson, and Princess Diana. BBC, Great Britons. Churchill, presented by Mo Molem. A large painting of cavalry in a grand ornate building.
Blenheim Palace. It's the grandest house I've ever seen.
Stone statues and carvings.
It's the home of the Marlborough family. Winston Churchill's grandfather was the 7th Duke of Marlborough.
Now rows of intricately painted toy soldiers.
Being born into the British Empire's governing elite must have had an effect on young Winston. It's no wonder he developed such a strong sense of destiny.
A weathered statue of a lion. Mo is in the palace grounds.
Lady Randolph Churchill was out riding here in 1874 when she was suddenly seized with contractions. She was rushed to the house and Winston was born. Impatient as ever, he was 6 weeks early.
She carries on through the grounds which lead up to a magnificent grand pillared entrance. A sepia portrait of Winston as a small boy. The ornate interior of Blenheim Palace.
Winston spent most of his holidays here as a child, running up and down the corridors with his cousins, surrounded by victorious images of war.
Mo stops by the grandiose cavalry painting from earlier.
There he is, the Duke of Marlborough. John Churchill, the first Duke of Marlborough, was his greatest hero. He had beaten the French at the Battle of Blenheim in 1704 and was given this palace as his reward.
An impressive hallway. Row upon row of miniature toy infantry soldiers, now the cavalry.
War must have seemed a pretty glorious business to young Winston, living here in a palace surrounded by war memorabilia and symbols. He used to play with his tin soldiers like all young boys do, lining them up ready for battle. But one gets a feeling that his battles were of more significance than for most young boys.
The painting of the first Duke of Marlborough, John Churchill, looking out over his vast armies marching into battle. Now, a photo of the young Winston with his mother.
This should have been a pretty carefree existence, but sadly for Winston, it wasn't. Like many Victorian children of his class, he was kept out of his parents' way and was packed off to boarding school when he was 8. And at 13, he was sent to Harrow. In the photos, he looks confident. But according to teachers, he was constantly in scrapes and not to be trusted.
Winston is a schoolboy in uniform and top hat.
He was a small and sickly child. He wasn't clever. He had a lisp and a stammer, and he soon became a natural target for bullies. If you're being bullied at school, the first people you would turn to for help are your parents. But they didn't support him. His mother, Jenny, was a very powerful New York heiress. She was clever and she was beautiful. He loved her profoundly, but she was cold and distant to him. When he was as old as 17, he was still writing letters like this one to his mother, begging for love and attention. My darling mummy, why have you not written to me as you said you would? I am so wretched. Even now I weep. Don't let my silly letters make you angry. Let me at least think that you love me. Darling mummy, I despair. I am so wretched. I don't know what to do. Don't be angry. I am so miserable.
It's signed, "Please, darling mummy, do write to your loving son, Winston S. Churchill."
As for his father, Randolph Churchill, he was no better. He was one of the most notorious politicians of his day, and Winston was very proud of him. But Randolph was so busy seeking power and fame that he would go for months on end without seeing his children. When he did, he was often bad-tempered and critical of his eldest son.
Voting is now closed.
As Winston left school, Randolph told him that if he went on leading such an idle, useless and unprofitable life, he would end up a failure and a social wastrel, with only himself to blame.
Another sepia photo of the young Winston looking dapper.
But Churchill later wrote that it was his father who had given him the drive to succeed.
"Solitary trees, if they grow at all, grow strong. And a boy deprived of his father's care often develops, if he escapes the perils of youth, an independence of vigour and thought, which may restore in afterlife the heavy loss of early days."
The sun beats down overhead in a cloudless sky as a train trundles through a dusty, arid landscape.
Years later, in 1898, Winston found himself on a train travelling through Egypt on his way to join General Kitchener's 21st Lancers in the Sudan. He was about to take part in one of the last great battles of the Imperial Age. It had taken him 3 attempts to get into Sandhurst Military Academy. In the end, he'd had to go to a London crammer. But Churchill was restless for adventure and did everything he could to get posted to the front.
Churchill in army attire, on horseback.
When he heard about Lord Kitchener's campaign in the Sudan, he was keen to get in on the act. To pay his way, he got a contract as a war correspondent for the Morning Post.
Mo speaks from a train carriage.
He was only 24 years old, but when the time for battle came on September the 2nd, 1898, he was up for it.
She glances out through the blinds in the train window.
The Battle of Omdurman was between the British and the Dervishes, who were fighting for their homeland and their extreme version of Islam. As several thousand Dervish troops advanced on foot over the horizon, with the sun glinting on their spears and the vultures circling overhead, Churchill was spellbound. He was one of 400 British horsemen ordered to charge. It was to be the last great cavalry charge in military history. That evening, Churchill wrote,
"The whole scene flickered exactly like a cinematograph picture. I remember no sound. The whole event seemed to pass in absolute silence. The yells of the enemy, the shouts of the soldiers, the firing of many shots, the clashing of sword and spear were unnoticed by the senses, unregistered by the brain."
The charge was over in minutes. A fifth of Churchill's regiment were dead. And then the British opened fire, and 10,000 dervishes were killed.
Railway tracks and gravel rush by.
Churchill wrote in the Morning Post how he'd come within inches of his death.
For the first time that morning, I experienced a sudden sensation of fear. I thought those riflemen would hit me and the rest devour me like wolves. But nothing touched me. I destroyed those who molested me and passed through without disturbance of body or mind.
The freckled face of Churchill as a young man.
It was amazing that he escaped unharmed. The experience, however, reinforced his belief that he had a sense of destiny. As he wrote to his mother, "I believe I am watched over. Think of the perils I have escaped."
The train continues on. Now a bustling station and a train pulling into its platform.
Churchill knew the time was right to launch his political career. He had made a name for himself and he had earned enough money from his writing and lectures to fund an election campaign back home. All he needed now was a constituency.
Looking out over a mass of smoking chimneys atop the terraced houses in Oldham.
And this was it, the working class borough of Oldham, home to the cotton mills of Lancashire. Like many politicians, he had no particular connections with the place or the people. It just happened to be the next available Tory seat. Churchill had used his time in the army to educate himself in history and philosophy. By the time he set off for Westminster, he knew what he thought about the world.
Statues of other leaders and learned men at Westminster.
The year was 1900. Churchill was just 26 years old when he entered here, the House of Commons. He was immediately labelled a maverick because he joined the Tory party and didn't toe the line. He then swapped to the Liberals, and 20 years later, he was back with the Tories. He didn't really care about party politics. What he cared about was what he believed in, and what he believed in was Britain. It didn't make him popular with his colleagues. They accused him of being a turncoat and self-seeking opportunist, although they had to admit he was becoming a gifted speechmaker. But even this talent didn't come naturally to him. He had to overcome the stammer and lisp he'd had since childhood. Like most politicians, Churchill practiced his speeches. I used to, when I was here, for an hour before, I pretended I was talking to my mother. But Churchill practiced all day long, day after day. But on one occasion, Churchill forgot his words completely. He was utterly devastated, humiliated. He sat back down on the benches with his head in his hands. For most MPs, such an experience would destroy their confidence completely. But not Winston. It just made him stronger. His political vision was much more liberal than you might have thought. He wanted to improve people's quality of life. He fought for better labour conditions, trade union rights, old age pensions and prison reforms. He even wanted to get rid of the House of Lords. But don't get me wrong, this doesn't mean that Churchill was a liberal in every respect. He wasn't keen on women having the vote, and he strongly disapproved of the suffragettes' aggressive protests. It was Churchill who sent in the vicious Black and Tans, the special armed police force, to suppress Irish nationalism. Throughout his life, if he felt anyone was likely to rock the boat or challenge the law, he was never afraid to be ruthless.
Gunfire in a deserted street.
This brutality came to the fore when he was Home Secretary. In 1911, a group of East European anarchists had barricaded themselves into a house in Sydney Street in the East End of London. They had been caught trying to rob a jewellery shop and had killed three policemen in the shootout. This is the earliest record of Churchill on film. He behaved like the general he always wanted to be. He took charge and allowed the house to burn down with the anarchists inside.
The burnt-out shell of the building.
He had proved he liked to take the offensive. But it was a quality that in his next political post would nearly ruin him.
Flickering archive footage.
Churchill was appointed First Lord of the Admiralty. He was now in charge of the biggest navy in the world, and he loved it.
A photograph of him looking back at the camera.
When war broke out in 1914, he urged the Prime Minister to take the offensive. There must be other alternatives, he said, than sending our armies to chew barbed wire in Flanders.
Men loading a torpedo on a ship.
The solution, he believed, was a naval attack on Turkey, which, if successful, would prepare the way for the Allied occupation of the strategically important Gallipoli Peninsula.
A battleship.
It was an ambitious mission and very risky. But on the 18th of March 1915, 18 British ships entered the Straits.
They sail in a line.
They were met with mines at sea and fire from the Turkish forts. 700 men were killed.
Smoke billows on the coastline and a ship is hit.
It was supposed to be Churchill's moment of glory, but like the rest of the Gallipoli campaign, it was an unmitigated disaster. Churchill was removed from the Admiralty.
A photograph of his emotionless face. Then the sinking hulls of ships. The funnels disappearing beneath the churning waves.
It was the most crushing blow to his pride. Churchill felt he had let the nation down.
From a blurred photo to gentle waves with white foam crests.
He had always been prone to bouts of depression. He called them his black dog. And now he fell into his worst depression ever.
Mo stands and gazes out to sea. The image blurs as the wind ripples through her hair. Now, a cloud-filled sky and a classical statue.
This time, he didn't have to face it alone. A few years earlier, Churchill had fallen in love with Clementine Hozier across a dinner table in London. She was 11 years younger than him. She was clever, intelligent, and good-looking. For Winston, it was love at first sight.
A picture of Clementine. She has large, deep eyes, and her dark hair is carefully sculpted.
Within a matter of weeks, he invited her to Blenheim. They were out walking when it began to rain.
Mo stops opposite a temple.
Winston led Clemmie here to the Temple of Diana. It had taken him 2 days to work up the courage. He asked her to marry him, and she said yes.
She stares up at the temple with its four iconic columns.
Clemmie was to provide the love, affection and stability that Winston had craved for as a boy. In many ways, he must have been an impossible husband, but he adored her, and unlike many other ambitious men, he was utterly loyal and loving to his family. After Gallipoli, Clemmie thought he would die of grief, but she remained constant and strong. She had to be. To make amends for his military blunder, Winston left Clemmie and their three young children at home and went to fight in the trenches of France.
A huge explosion sends tons of earth flying into the air.
It was a staggering thing to do for a former First Lord of the Admiralty. But it was also typical Churchill behaviour. It was the only way he could fight off the black dog of depression and maintain his self-belief.
Footage of soldiers in the trenches.
And it worked. Amid all the horror and squalor of the war we've come to know as the most terrible ever, he wrote to Clemmie.
I have found happiness and content such as I have not known for many months. And certainly I have never been better in health and spirits.
It was a strange irony that only a few miles behind enemy lines, there was another soldier destined to become leader of his country, Adolf Hitler.
The young Hitler in a group photograph. Now, Mo is on a train cutting through the English countryside.
Churchill returned to England in 1917 and did everything he could to resurrect his political career. First, he was made Minister of Munitions for the Liberals. And then in 1924, he joined the Tories again and was made Chancellor of the Exchequer. He was now in his 50s, but Churchill hoped he was back on track.
Fields and trees roll past.
Then in 1930, Labour came to power. It had all gone wrong again. He was consigned to the backbenches and retired quietly to his country estate.
A photograph showing Churchill holding a large fishing net while dressed in a pristine suit and smoking a cigar.
Why do you whisper green grass?
Now, a comfortable country manor.
This is where he began to spend more and more of his time, Chartwell in Kent. It was to become one of the most important places in British history. Clemmy always hated it, but Churchill loved the setting.
Why tell them all your secrets?
He set about transforming it into an English gentleman's paradise. He found it hard to enjoy life without the pressures of politics. But once again, he fought off the black dog of depression with frenetic energy.
Mo walks through a rose garden.
He took up painting. He built garden walls with his own hands. He planted orchards, designed rose gardens, and created lakes. And from his study, he wrote books about his ancestors and the great wars he'd fought in.
Smiling, he closes a top window.
But even from this peaceful country retreat, he sensed there were troubles ahead.
A sleek black car pulls up, and a German officer opens the door, giving Adolf Hitler a Nazi salute as he climbs out.
From the early 1930s, Winston became increasingly worried about the growing popularity of Nazism in Germany. Long before there was enough evidence to justify his fears, he suspected that Adolf Hitler would prove a menace to more than just his own people. The storm clouds were gathering.
Thousands of young men raising their arms in the Nazi salute.
Most British people couldn't face the thought of more fighting. They could still remember the pain and suffering from the Great War. They supported the government's policy of disarmament and appeasement. They were much more interested to hear what Hitler had to say about peace than what Churchill had to say about war. But Churchill began to broadcast his fears to the nation.
It is startling and fearful to realize that we are no longer safe in our island home. For nearly 1,000 years, England has never...
Nur seine eigene Führung und seine eigenen Arbeit. Das Ausland hat dazu gar nichts beigetragen.
A Nazi rally.
There is a nation which with all its strength and virtue is in the grip of a group of ruthless men preaching a gospel of intolerance and racial pride. Now they are rearming with the utmost speed.
Thousands of bullet casings revolve on a conveyor as a disciplined army marches on.
He made that speech in 1934, 5 years before the rest of Europe had any idea of what was going on.
Hitler strides confidently down an aisle.
Perhaps it was because Hitler and Churchill shared certain qualities. Both men had tremendous drive. Both were great orators, capable of exercising enormous influence over their audience. And both men believed that it was their destiny to lead their nation.
Night falls on Chartwell.
But there, the comparisons end. For Churchill, a nation's democratic freedom is everything. He knew Hitler was a dictator who didn't believe in freedom, who just wanted total control, not just of Germany, but of Europe and beyond.
Yes, you told them once before, it's no secret anymore.
Churchill always called these the wilderness years, but his family home in the 30s became the epicentre of resistance to Hitler in Europe, an alternative Whitehall for politicians and anti-Nazi supporters.
The large house is silhouetted against a grey sky.
Friends in the Foreign Office were passing him secret information which proved Hitler was creating a massive military force with alarming speed. As Churchill gathered evidence to back up his fears, he tried to impress on his visitors that Britain should urgently be preparing for war.
In a comfortable room in Chartwell, Churchill leans over a book, deeply engrossed.
Maybe out here in Chartwell, Churchill did believe he was speaking from the wilderness, but he still believed that the destiny of the nation was in his hands. When Chamberlain signed the Treaty of Munich in 1938, allowing Germany to occupy northern Czechoslovakia, Churchill knew that it was war, not peace, that beckoned.
Chamberlain holds aloft the treaty.
This is only the beginning of the reckoning. This is only the first sip, the first foretaste of a bitter cup which will be proffered to us year by year, unless, by a supreme recovery of moral health and martial vigor, we arise again and take our stand for freedom.
Churchill is sitting at his desk concentrating on his papers as a thick layer of mist settles on the English countryside. Now, a photograph of Churchill with his trademark cigar in his mouth.
In Germany, Hitler tried to make out that Churchill was the aggressor.
That gossiping, drunkard Churchill. What has he ever really achieved? That lying, good for nothing.
But in March 1939, Hitler engulfed the rest of Czechoslovakia.
A Nazi article with Hitler's photo in it.
And on the 1st of September, he launched an assault on Poland. 2 days later, at 11:15 in the morning, on Sunday, the 3rd of September, 1939, Churchill's predictions and everybody's fears came true.
A bomber-filled sky.
Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain broadcast to the nation.
The British ambassador in Berlin ended the German government a final note, stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany.
Footage of people in gas masks.
Sirens filled the air.
Covering windows during the blackout and hurrying into air raid shelters.
Men were called up to fight. Children were evacuated from cities all around the country.
Tearful women in the streets.
German bombs were expected to fall from the skies at any time. As people scuttled into the air raid shelters, they must have wondered if life would ever be the same again.
The Home Guard on patrol.
In the spring of 1940, Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain was still hankering to strike a deal with Hitler.
A tank flattening trees.
But on the 10th of May, Hitler marched into Belgium and the Netherlands. The most terrifying and efficient fighting machine ever was now only a few miles across the Channel. And we were completely unprepared. Chamberlain was forced to resign. The British people wanted a man who knew how to fight. Soon after 6 p.m. that day, Churchill became Prime Minister.
Goodbye, Mr. Chamberlain, and thanks for all you've tried to do. We welcome the new Prime Minister, Mr. Churchill.
He was 65 years old, but his moment had finally come. He faced the challenge with a calm confidence. He later wrote,
I was conscious of a profound sense of relief. I felt as if I were walking with destiny, and that all my past life had been but a preparation for this hour and this trial. I was sure I should not fail. Therefore, although impatient for the morning, I slept soundly and had no need for cheering dreams.
Planes bomb a convoy of fleeing civilians.
Only 3 days after Churchill had become Prime Minister, the situation in Europe became even more desperate. Hitler's troops marched into France. Churchill tried to persuade the French not to give in, but on May 27th, he was forced to order all British troops to withdraw from Dunkirk before more lives were lost.
Boats full of soldiers bobbing across the sea, unstoppable tanks, and German troops marching down the Champs-Élysées.
But on June 17th, after only 6 weeks, the French surrendered. Britain now stood alone on the brink of invasion. It was probably the most dangerous moment in our history. But Churchill stood defiant. He forbade all peace dealings with the Nazis. He insisted that surrender wasn't an option.
In full uniform, Hitler reading some papers as he walks.
The Battle of Britain was about to begin. Churchill gave a call to arms and stirred the country's spirit in a way that nothing had before.
She turns and looks out towards the English Channel.
Upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilization. Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be free. But if we fail, then the whole world, including all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age. Let us, therefore, brace ourselves to our duties, and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
A spinning propeller.
More than 60 years ago, those words were uttered, and I still can't listen to them without feeling very emotional. He made war seem honourable and heroic. He made defeat seem impossible. He made every individual proud of the part they played in history. Our individual survival stood for nothing less than the survival of the whole civilised world.
A Spitfire flying low past the distinctive white cliffs of Dover.
We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender.
The plane flies on, cruising above lush green countryside.
Throughout the summer of 1940, the Battle of Britain was waged along the south coast. Unlike any other battle before, it was fought in the air.
Old footage of Spitfires escorting bomber runs across the Channel. A squadron of Spitfires banking in formation.
At times, the situation must have seemed hopeless. By September, over half of our pilots had been shot down.
Combat in the skies. Several planes plummet with flames streaking from their tails. Churchill studying the sky.
But Churchill enthused everyone with his energy. He had appointed himself Minister of Defence as well as Prime Minister, and frequently turned up in person at Fighter Command to watch events unfold at the plotting table. On one occasion, Churchill broke the silence in the room to ask, "What other reserves have we?" And he was told, "Prime Minister, there are none."
A plane crashes, and a massive cloud of flames rises up.
Against all the odds, our Spitfires fended off invasion.
Aerial footage of bombs being dropped.
But it wasn't over yet. The Germans started launching bombing raids on our cities.
Great balls of fire scarring the English countryside. Raging infernos rip through buildings, and men with hoses futilely try to quench the flames.
They bombed docks and factories and people's homes. They bombed London, Portsmouth, Coventry and Sheffield. This was the Blitz. It killed 22,000 civilians. 2 million Britons were made homeless.
All around, the devastation of buildings reduced to rubble.
Hitler wanted to force Britain to the negotiating table and oust Churchill from office. Hitler was sure that relentless bombing would break the country's spirit.
A German bomber releases its payload.
The end may be far off. We cannot tell. That depends upon the enemy. How long he will resist, we cannot tell. How long that wicked man will torture and afflict the nations, how often or in what directions he will set his murder machine in motion, we cannot tell.
Men in flat caps standing in a street that's been razed to the ground.
But Churchill stayed in London throughout, a symbol of defiance for the nation.
Churchill on a walkabout, talking to a fireman.
He was a natural showman and leader, deliberately using the cigar and hat as his props. He made people feel that they were all part of a great collective war effort. With Clemmy at his side, he showed them that their Prime Minister was with them, sharing their danger and their fear. Hitler's attack on British morale backfired. The Blitz only stiffened the country's resolve to fight to the bitter end.
Anti-aircraft guns aiming into the sky, and a line of intelligence correspondence staff manning the telephones.
As the bombs continued to fall, Churchill moved the cabinet underground to the war rooms in Whitehall.
Mo walks along the bare brick underground corridor. Old footage of a man putting pins into a map.
Most politicians work incredibly long hours, but Churchill managed to cram more work into one day than anyone else I've ever known. He used to invite his ministers late at night to his bedside to discuss new strategies. He managed to get through the night by drinking quite a large amount of champagne and an enormous number of oysters. Churchill could be dictatorial, which now helped to cut through red tape and bureaucracy to get things done. Surrounded by maps in his underground bedroom, he involved himself in every detail, from jam rationing to the manufacture of playing cards. Hitler accused Churchill of being an alcoholic. He told the German people that Churchill's speeches were the ravings of a drunkard. I think his alcohol and his cigars were great stress relievers. He insisted that I have taken more out of alcohol than alcohol has taken out of me.
She takes a sip of whiskey.
At times, the pressure did get to him. He could be moody and rude to his staff, as Clemmy pointed out in a letter.
There's a danger of your being generally disliked by your colleagues because of your rough, sarcastic and overbearing manner. My darling Winston, I must confess I've noticed a deterioration. You give the orders, you can sack anyone and everyone. Therefore, with this terrific power, you must combine urbanity, kindness, and if possible, Olympic calm.
But the single-mindedness that made him so difficult to work with also made him a brilliant strategist.
Mo studies a map of occupied Europe.
Britain still hadn't had a victory. By the summer of 1941, Hitler had pushed even further into Europe. Norway, Denmark, Greece, Crete, and Yugoslavia had all fallen. He was master of Central and Western Europe. And then in June, the Germans invaded Russia. Churchill immediately embraced Stalin and the Russian people as allies. He hated communism, but a Russian front would keep Hitler busy. Churchill's advisers started to push for an invasion of France, but he doggedly refused. He knew Britain wasn't ready. He knew that to defeat Hitler, he had to persuade the Americans to join in.
Waves rolling over a battleship deck.
What was needed was careful diplomacy. On 9th of August 1941, Churchill set off to Newfoundland to meet President Roosevelt in person. The two men may not have agreed on political and military strategy. Roosevelt thought Churchill was an old-fashioned imperialist and found his relentless energy and late-night talks exhausting. But like most people, Roosevelt was blown away by Churchill's charm.
The two men sharing a joke.
No promises were made, but the personal friendship they formed on board that ship was to prove crucial to Britain. And then the bond was sealed.
Japanese warplanes in formation. A gunner trains his weapon on the ground. A bomb blows up a battleship.
In December 1941, the Japanese attacked the American fleet at Pearl Harbor. Britain now had a new and powerful ally. Never one to miss an opportunity, Churchill left for Washington at once to persuade the Americans that Germany, and not Japan, was enemy number one.
Mo fills up a standalone bath.
While Churchill was staying at the White House, Roosevelt came to his room one night to continue their talks. He discovered the Prime Minister in the bath. Before Roosevelt could leave the room, Churchill had stood up in his bath without the cover of a towel and said, "The Prime Minister of Great Britain has nothing to hide from the President of the United States."
Churchill in a bathing suit going backwards down a slide and plunging into the sea.
The British and American people will, for their own safety and for the good of all, walk together in majesty, in justice, and in peace.
The American congressmen get to their feet.
At last, we had a fighting partner. Together, we agreed to free the civilized world from Hitler's tyranny.
A 4x4 drives towards the sun as it sinks behind the horizon. Majestic Egyptian pyramids in the desert.
Typically, Winston took it on himself to try to turn the tables. In August 1942, he travelled to Egypt to see his troops. After 2 years of continued defeats, we desperately needed a victory. Churchill believed our best chance was in North Africa. Before launching an Anglo-American invasion, he wanted to assess the situation for himself. The journey was long and difficult. And for a man in his 60s, it must have been really tough. But Winston insisted that battles are not won by sitting still and doing nothing. The front line is where the danger is, and that is where Churchill just had to be.
From the present day to footage of Churchill in the desert.
When he got to the British Army headquarters in the Western Desert, he was shocked by what he found. He wrote to Clemmie saying,
"This splendid army, about double as strong as the enemy, is baffled and bewildered by its defeat. A kind of apathy and exhaustion of the mind rather than the body has stolen over our troops, which only new strong hands, and above all the gleam of victory, can dispel.
Mo stands consulting a map of North Africa on the bonnet of her 4x4.
The Germans had been steadily pushing towards Egypt. By the time Churchill arrived, the British had been forced to retreat as far back as the town of El Alamein. Churchill took a drastic step and intervened personally, handing the job of beating Rommel to Montgomery. I'm sure he'd have liked to take the post himself, but in Monty he found someone with the same kind of charisma that he had. It was a risky decision. Monty was neither popular with the troops nor experienced in desert warfare, but Churchill recognised a fellow believer in destiny.
Footage of the pair.
He saw Monty had the courage, drive and self-belief that was needed. It was a brilliant decision. From that moment, British fortunes changed.
Mo and her driver set off across the desert.
On the 23rd of October 1942, Monty opened the Battle of El Alamein with a daring night attack.
A rich salmon-pink sun.
The guns began at 9 p.m. with a shattering roar.
The night sky becomes ablaze with explosions.
The battle continued for 12 hard-fought days, but at last Rommel's front was broken. The Germans had been defeated.
From clouds of thick black smoke billowing on the front line to the peaceful desert today.
The famous victory at El Alamein was a turning point in the war.
An abandoned boot and a German plane nose first in the sand.
We have victory. A remarkable and definite victory. A bright gleam has caught the helmets of our soldiers and warmed and cheered all our hearts. Ah, this is not the end. It is not even the beginning of the end. But it is perhaps the end of the beginning.
A room full of men in dinner suits gives Churchill a standing ovation.
Winston ordered every church in Britain to ring out its bells in celebration for the first time since war began.
The Spitfire again, cruising past the white cliffs of Dover. From a black and white photo of Churchill giving his victory salute, to footage of him getting into the back of an RAF plane.
I've flown around the world in a plane.
For the next 2 years, Churchill continued to travel relentlessly. To Casablanca, Tehran, Algiers, Malta and Alexandria. He inspired his troops on the ground and plotted the road to victory with Stalin and Roosevelt.
Now, at the White House.
But all this travelling and pressure was beginning to take its toll. As early as 1941, Churchill had had a mild heart attack as he struggled to open a window at the White House. In 1943, he suffered from pneumonia and almost died after his trip to Tehran. Doctors constantly told him to rest, but Churchill insisted that endurance was the key to winning the war. KBO was always his motto, and he was determined to keep buggering on.
He puffs on a cigar in a mess tent.
Whatever happened, he wanted to be there to witness Hitler's defeat for himself.
From German officers looking across the channel at the white cliffs of Dover, to Allied troops boarding vessels.
In May 1944, American and British forces prepared for D-Day and the final assault on Fortress Europe. Churchill was desperate to be on the Normandy beaches to watch his troops land. What fun it would be, he thought, to get there before Monty.
Grainy footage of boats landing on the Normandy beaches and troops disembarking.
It was as if Churchill wanted to die in battle, like so many British heroes had done before him.
Soldiers wading waist-deep in water to reach the shore.
Only the King had the guts to stop him. He told Churchill that if he went, they both went.
A photo of the two men. Now, troops being shot down on the beaches.
Churchill agreed to wait 6 days before he crossed the Channel to join the action.
An injured German soldier salutes Hitler.
Hitler was smiling for the cameras, but he knew it was only a matter of time.
Next, parachutists jumping out of a plane.
The Allied forces began the long and bloody fight through Europe. The end was in sight.
Hundreds of parachutes drifting through the sky.
And on the 8th of May, 1945, it came.
This is the British people's finest day. D-Day, the end of the German war. Throughout the country, at homes and at work, a nation exploded with spontaneous rejoicing for a great and wonderful deliverance.
Crowds of people waving Union Jack flags, cheering and looking ecstatic.
Victory in Europe was declared. Churchill was cheered as the nation's hero, the saviour of his country.
Churchill giving the victory sign.
This is your victory. Victory of the cause of freedom is every day.
People do the conga, a brass band playing, and people dancing in the streets. A woman takes a swig of beer. A couple dances, and people come to join the ever-growing conga line in the street. Next, colour film of row upon row of white gravestones.
But alongside the victory and euphoria were the scars from 5 years of suffering and pain. Churchill had been so preoccupied with the war, he hadn't given much thought to the question of reconstruction at home. It was Attlee and the Labour Party who understood that people needed homes, jobs and a welfare state. The British people wanted rewards for the sacrifices they had made.
The sun glinting through trees above the graveyard.
As every politician knows, public opinion can change. No one doubted Churchill was the greatest leader of all time, but he was now in his 70s. The very soldiers who had fought for him were not convinced he was the right man to rebuild Britain. In July 1945, Labour was elected to government with a landslide victory. Churchill was devastated after all the hard work that he had done. But I think he had an inkling. But a couple of months before, he had written to a friend, "I have a strong feeling that my work is now done."
A painting of John Churchill on horseback.
His job was indeed done. Churchill had fulfilled his destiny. But he still wasn't ready to leave the political scene. He was addicted to it. He stayed on in Parliament as leader of the opposition.
Churchill emerging from a plane.
To some, he seemed a relic from a bygone age, but Churchill remained a great visionary. He was one of the first to urge the states of Europe to unite. As early as 1946, he warned that an iron curtain had descended on Europe and that Stalin's Russia would one day be as dangerous as Nazi Germany.
People and photographers lining the streets near Downing Street.
At the age of 77, he was voted in again for a second term as Prime Minister. 4 years later, he finally retired.
A black and white photograph of an elderly Churchill giving the victory sign and smoking his customary cigar. A flock of birds flies off, startled by the cannon shots. Then people lining the streets in mourning. The somber procession of a state funeral, with Churchill's coffin draped with the Union Jack flag, being ferried along on a carriage.
Churchill died on the 24th of January 1965 at the age of 90. The nation mourned as it had never mourned before.
The wheels of the carriage bearing Churchill's coffin roll on.
60s Britain was a very different world from the one that Churchill had known, but hundreds of thousands of people queued in the bitter cold to pay their tributes at his coffin.
Feet walking along the pavement.
As his coffin travelled along the Thames, the great cranes along the south side of the river dipped their masts in tribute.
The tall cranes soaring against a white sky.
"I am prepared to meet my Maker," he said a few years earlier. Whether my Maker is prepared for the ordeal of meeting me is another matter. He was finally laid to rest in a village graveyard near Blenheim Palace.
Brooding clouds above the village graveyard. Now Mo Molem is walking up the path towards the church.
Churchill is remembered today as the man who won us the war. And it's true, he did. You don't win wars without the support of the people. And through his cigar, his victory sign, his sheer determination, he won the support of the British people and led us to victory. He has gone, but thanks to him, Britain lives on.
From Mo standing looking at Churchill's gravestone to a photo of the kindly features of the man himself.
If Britain, with its eccentricities, its big-heartedness and its strength of character, has to be summed up in one person, it just has to be Winston Churchill.